And this is, so we have 2 years of stuff planned out, and it's kind of a perfect amount for me. It's a lot of work, but it's not like undoable with my other jobs. It keeps me doing some comic stuff, and then I get to do the covers, and you know, just, and oh man, I just, all I do like for work now is watch Gotcha Man, and I have to buy the toys because it helps me with Reverend. Yeah.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tradecraft Podcast. I'm Alex. Well, what kind of kicked this whole podcast thing off 4.5 years ago was an art residency my wife took in Ireland, and she was gone for a while. So this is pre-pandemic, and hopped online with some art college friends, and we were hanging out, talking, the drawing, and then we just kept hanging out with kind of new people, and yeah, time goes by, and it became a podcast. She left this last week for another art residency, which is great. So she'll be off exploring her creative powers. And I promise I won't start another podcast, but in the interest of, you know, holding up my end on just keeping life as uncomplicated as possible, I pulled a ton of boxes out that I have been meaning to attend to. So the house is a wreck. It is just covered with all sorts of things. And I think she would just explode into atoms if she saw this. But my philosophy has always been, you have to make a big mess before you can clean it up. Yeah, it seems to be my full part-time job. This week's guest is Tommy Lee Edwards. And Tommy is, you know, the guy. Everyone knows Tommy Lee's work. He done amazing projects over the years, and not just in comic books, but in games and in television. He's just kind of a renaissance person. I've been on his case for a while, have him on the show. And then when I got wind, he was sort of spearheading the comic book effort by Mad Cave for the Gotcha Men property, I kind of lost my mind, because this was a cartoon that I fell in love with in the late 70s. So I quickly emailed him and said, you have to come on and we have to talk about this. You know, Tommy is a gearhead, loves cars, loves planes, loves motorcycles. I'm probably his biggest fan on Instagram for all his car stuff. So he's just a really interesting cat. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I sure as hell did. This is me with Tommy Lee Edwards. Were you the kid who just had all these things in the room growing up?
Yeah.
Yeah. And was it just an endless battle between you and your, you know, it was my mother to like, put it away, put that away.
I was pretty organized.
Really?
Actually. So yeah, like, and that, which is why I still have a lot of my stuff.
Right. Okay.
I have most of my Star Wars and G.I. Joe.
Okay.
And Mask, but only like some things. So Mask I've put and set up in my garage. My garage is what my wife calls the hobby house. I'm in the studio, which is the workhouse, and they're all separate from the live-in house. So the hobby house has some of my collection. So the studio right now where I am has all like my Godzillas and a lot of airplane stuff and robots and shit like that. And then my garage has my Speed Racer collection and my Batmobile collection and my Mask stuff. So it's kind of an automotive theme going there.
It makes complete sense to me. Yeah. It would confuse you. Now you need an aircraft hangar to put all the planes in.
That's right.
It doesn't have to be a big one, just like one of those regular size ones for like a Cessna.
Regular size. average homeowner size.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, it's what was the fascination? Was it the moving vehicles for you first, or was it I mean, because for me, I didn't get a chance to see any sort of exotic animation until maybe when I went to like Detroit on a family trip and saw Speed Racer for the first time, like in the early 70s, oh, you know?
Yeah. Speed Racer was the first anime I ever saw for sure. I think, and my dad was an engineer and my mom worked at the GM Proving Grounds. So it was always, and my grandpa worked at Cadillac and my mom and my aunt worked at Ford, and you know, my uncles worked at either, you know, GM or Ford, you know, depending, you know, so everybody kind of, you know, did all that kind of stuff all the time. And so yeah, animation and toys that were, you know, cars, you know, I played with Tonka, but you know, Tonka made trucks that were not like construction trucks, but like 4x4 kind of trucks. And then you had like a guy that was like a, you know, like a 6-inch tall guy who could sit in it and you could make jumps and everything. And, you know, so it was, oh, let me turn off my text here. But yeah, it was a lot of like, you know, those kinds of toys, but I like characters, you know? So that's where like, I think G.I. Joe was a big thing. Because it was that mix of the vehicles with the characters.
Yeah.
You know, when you could do more, like, stories more.
Yeah, there was that weird gap because, like, when I was little, like, up to about, like, 5 or 6 years old-ish, that's when the big G.I. Joes were out. And then that kind of, like, disappeared. And then, like, kind of Mego, like, took the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But, like, with, you know, they went from 12 inches to 8 inches. And then they kind of reigned for, you know, for the 70s. And then they just kind of disappeared in the tail end of like the Star Wars toys, the Micronauts, and then the 80s were ruled by the G.I. Joe figures.
Yeah, the three and a half inches.
I mean, listen, it's you know, it's a business. They're like, why, you know, like we can make just as much profit off of this 3.5-inch thing than a 12-inch thing.
Yeah, those are, I had ones from my uncle of the tall G.I. Joes, but I didn't. And I had a couple, but they were already, yeah, they were phasing out, you know, when I was, and so 1983, I think, when the small G.I. Joes were started to come out.
Okay.
Maybe 82. So I think it was 83. So I was in 83, I would have been 10.
Oh, you're like the perfect age.
Yeah. So that was, and then the comic came out. And that was my first monthly comic collection too. Oh. Like I bought comics all the time, but that was the first one that I was like counting down the weeks, you know, and the days and the, until I could go to the corner store and get the next issue.
Yeah. Well, that, so for me, it definitely was the Micronauts, and it was for the same reason. There were toys that you could sort of like carry on the story in your own mind between issues.
Yeah, it was the kind of stuff that you could draw your own stories, draw your own characters, read the comic, watch the cartoon, play with the toys inside, outside, and then play war outside, which is what I did all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, so dressing up with all the army gear and going out there. And, you know, so, I mean, I still have, like I said, I was so organized. I kept all these drawings I did that, me and a good friend of mine, Mike Bowman, when we were little, we would just draw all the time and draw each other's characters and, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons, you know, how you come up with your character and all that stuff. It was like that. We would come up with our characters, but never play Dungeons and Dragons.
Right. No, totally. I know. I think like I got my hands on the D&D books like in the late 70s, you know, figured out how to weasel that deal from a parent. And then like I had them, but like, it was impossible to wrap my brain about like how I'm going to like organize this, but I could sit there and draw those characters. I'm like, oh, I could draw a knight. I could draw like a monster. That was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My son got super into Dungeons and Dragons and still plays. He's 25 now. So that was like, you know, a huge part of his life. And he got into a lot of the vintage stuff and got a lot of the old books and everything from John Paul Leon had all the old stuff too.
Yeah.
And him and his brother, Alex, you know, played all the time. And JP gave my son Henry all of his old books and everything years ago, and it was awesome. It was like just the ultimate treasure, you know. So sometimes, yeah, keeping that stuff is like, my wife doesn't keep hardly anything. She just wants me to throw everything out, you know. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, it might be, it's fun to, there are some things I'm starting to get rid of because it's ridiculous. It's just taking up space now, you know?
I mean, I think I've said it more than once, but most likely most comic book creators will be found buried underneath a rubble of their own collection.
Yeah.
It's just, it's going to happen. That the shelves are really tall and they're covered with heavy objects.
Yeah. I had to build a whole new building so I could put my car seat in it. Yeah. So.
So did you grow up outside of Detroit?
Yeah, it was a little bit in Dearborn.
Yeah.
And where are you from?
Well, I'm from Connecticut, but my father was born and raised in Dearborn and all those.
Oh yeah, that's so right. Remember we talked about this one time a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. So I grew up, and he was an engineer. So I have a very similar sort of like obsession with mechanical stuff that's awesome. You do. Yeah. So hence, anytime you post anything with a car, I'm like, I'm the one who's asking very specific questions.
You're one of those few guys on Instagram that actually seems to understand or give a shit what I'm posting.
I mean, I'm not putting little pictures of flames and thumbs up on the responses, so no offense if you do. Carry on.
Fire.
Yeah, but so you had this sort of like, and by the way, the Detroit television stations had the best cartoons. Mm-hmm. It, like I said, that's where Speed Racer, so you and I saw the same
stuff. Yeah, we lucked out.
Yeah,
I have a guy I work with right now, who's a marketing guy at the company that I'm making this video game for. He always talks about certain shows, and he grew up in Toronto, and he was like, "Oh my god, he didn't meet a lot of people that knew the same shows that he did, and a lot of it was stuff like Speed Racer and Star Blazers,
Ultraman. You guys had Ultraman.
Yeah, Ultraman, Johnny Sacco and his flying robot, mm-hmm. or giant robo. Ultraman is a huge one, and still to this day, I have my Ultraman collection in my house. That's one of the things I have in my house, and my Kamen Rider collection.
Okay,
I have problems, but yeah, that's one of the few things that my wife is allowed to have
in
the house. So, partly because Ultraman and Kamen Rider are more like colorful kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And for a while, like, our living room was very dark. I had like, you know, a lot of dark art. I had a Bob Peak, original Bob Peak drawing, a comp of Rollerball.
Oh, wow.
And it was all like a lot of like, so we made a conscious effort to brighten up our the inside of our house. So now I actually just recently dropped off last week an original Ultraman Returns poster from 1973 to get framed, and it's being framed with like a red and silver and all this stuff, so to go in the house.
That's
so
cool.
I got that when I was in Japan a few months ago.
Oh, right. I remember you were posting just a long list of images from that trip.
Yeah. Well, that was awesome.
Was it a work trip or that was just go to Japan?
No, it was for fun. Okay. And I went with a couple friends, and I've always wanted to go, and my dad used to go when I was little for different, you know, car manufacturers he was working with. And then my first job was, I worked at a Japanese stamping plant in Michigan, and it was, so my dad would also work for that company and then would go to Japan, and I always wanted to go. And the sport I played my whole life was judo. So we always had a lot of ties to Japanese stuff. And then my dad would bring like manga back from Japan and, anime books, like books about mm-hmm. shows and stuff. So he knew what I liked, you know, so he would come home with all that kind of stuff. Then my mom would go through it, and she would, with scissors, cut out anything that was questionable, like, like, you know, nudity and anything that was too violent and stuff, which drove me absolutely nuts. You know, but I guess you gotta.
I mean, she's being a parent.
She's committed. That's a commitment.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of the stuff like the TV shows in Detroit, we would rent movies and pirate them, like to put two VCRs together, mm-hmm. and get like, let's say, RoboCop. And when it was about, and so we would record it, but then my mom would watch it and do the same thing. She would then, RoboCop would be playing, and right when Ed 209 is about to blow that guy away in the mm-hmm. in the meeting, all of a sudden the picture would get real fuzzy and it would go into like TV. So it would be like the news or cartoons or whatever was on at the time. My mom would record over that scene and get rid of that scene. And then would go back to the movie. So yeah, she put a lot of work into.
Wow. But you know, what's so funny is thinking about that. Like if there is a single movie, especially from the '80s, that actually seems like an additive effect. Mm-hmm. Like that movie is, that's actually like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'd buy that for $1. Yeah. Show.
Right. It's like, it's almost like, cause like when Frank did RoboCop 2, it had a lot more ads crammed in there. And that just feels like on point for the, so tell your funny. Hats off to your mom for being on brand with her editorial.
So yeah, it was good. It was, you know, I loved comics, and like when I was in junior high, I think I got more into, you know, like X-Men and mm-hmm. stuff like that, and then into high school, and it was more like that Chris Claremont, J.R. Jr., Paul Smith, you know, that 80s stuff, and then I loved that How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way book, mm-hmm. you know, and all that kind of stuff, you know, just total 80s kid.
Yeah. Well, that was all. That was all these entry points. And I think one of the things you cited with your buddy, Mike, you said his name was. Like you guys, you drew together, and I think it's like having mm-hmm. that confederate in these kind of these sort of fringe activities that keep you engaged. Because totally. Without that confederate, man, it just goes, well, I'll just grab a soccer ball.
Yeah.
Because that's what everyone else is doing versus like, hey, we can put our heads down and do the thing, and whatever the thing is. Like I remember senior year of high school, I'm like 18 years old, and my buddy and I were hanging out, and like we opened up a box and it was filled with our AFX cars. So the, you know, the electric track, and you
agree.
He's like, I've got a whole box of this stuff. So we set our tracks up, and you know, rather than going out, like we would sit and race these cars for like a couple of weeks. Like we're like, this was the greatest thing, because we were just having the best time trying to soup them up, adding extra power converters just to see if we could get more, you know, juice out of these things. And it was a blast. But like, I never would have done it had he not been hanging out with me. So,
right.
Yeah. And we didn't end up in jail. So that's a good bonus.
That you didn't?
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't. Okay. Yeah. I thought you said you did.
Which like, would oh, that know. That's the real story. How I ended up in jail playing FX cars.
That's my grandma, sometimes I'd get a little bit of crap from like other, like my parents or relatives for having too many like comics and things. And like I mentioned, like when I worked at that stamping plant, I was way too young. I was, because my dad worked for the company, I was able to, you know, kind of sneak in there. Mm-hmm. And I was literally in eighth grade. So, and I would do everything from landscaping to, driving a fork truck, you know? So I would just, I got $5 an hour. So, you know, this is 1987 or whatever. So I was loaded, you know? So I would just buy comics like crazy. And my grandma always said, well, at least he's not, you know, buying drugs or doing something stupid,
right?
He's going and working, and what's he buying? Comics. He's reading and, you know, using his imagination and feeling his drawing stuff, and mm-hmm. so yeah, it was definitely good hobbies, you know.
Yeah.
And you'd give them to your buddies,
yeah,
trade them.
Oh man, it was,
I had
the best.
Some really valuable G.I. Joes, and I traded them to Mike for some Hot Wheel cars like an asshole.
Oh.
But
they're probably still worth more than Hot Wheels too.
Yeah,
my first job was working at a
strip club.
It was a hydraulic manifold manufacturing, design and manufacturing facility.
That's cool.
Yeah. So my dad, being an engineer, he worked for this company. So I was like operating, you know, like heavy industrial machinery and assembling these things at 14. Like that was my little job. And then I did that all the way through 16. So
that's awesome.
It was great. And
it's great to be around adults, like grown ups and stuff. And
who aren't your family, you know, who will swear around you and not like go, you know, like they behave as they do and you have to adapt.
Yeah. And it did for me, but probably gave you a lot of skills on how to, you know, deal with people and in general. Mm-hmm. And then when you got more like, you know, then I had a terrible job, but then I went and worked at Burger King for a little bit and I had to deal with adults there. And I was like, that didn't last long.
Yeah.
And then I worked at the movie theater as the projectionist and I never left upstairs. I was like, we had five or six screens. And so I ran all of them and just kind of was like the phantom, you know, up mm-hmm. there and never left, you know, so nice. That was a good job too. That was in the old days when you had to loop it all up and everything in the big platters and,
right,
you know, splice the reels together. That was great.
And wait for the mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love
Listen to us old guys talking about this old stuff.
Hey man, this, you know, here's the funny thing. So when I left comic books in the late, well, I guess in 1999, 2000, I got into design and art direction. And it was so weird that I had, as you know, by osmosis, by doing, you know, color guides for my own work, understood how the printing process worked. Like mm-hmm. I understood how things were made in the world to begin with, but I could apply my understanding of that. So when it came to working on Photoshop or any of these things and putting an object together that needed to be produced, I had a head start. I had no idea that I had a head start until I'm like, oh, this is the same thing. Like that C2, you know, that I would mark down on that color guide, that's just cyan and it's 50%. Okay. I get this. And I understood overprinting and all these crazy things. But, you know, when you're doing the comic books, no one's pulling you aside, or at least no one pulled me aside and said, okay, well, here's what this means. And here's what this is doing. It was more of like, this is how you code it. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. You know, because I wanted to color my own stuff. I didn't want to have to rely on somebody else for coloring it in case, you know, well, you know.
Yeah, I'm still that way.
Yeah. Right. So it was, yeah, it was just like, it was an interesting kind of transition kind of period. So yeah, anything you learn, you can kind of change and apply to whatever the next thing you do, mm-hmm. if you pay attention.
Yeah. The job that I've been at the last 2 years as creative director of this company called Atmos Labs, and we're making this game, and a big part of the game is, you're able to customize this gear that your characters use in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it all comes from, like, my way to relate to it is my car hobby, you know? So it's all about customizing these pieces, fitting them together. How do they work? How do they stay together? How do they, you know, all the, just even today we're coming up with some new ideas, and so much of it goes back to, you know, what I learned on my, you know, car stuff. So yeah, it's cool to be able to apply it to other places, you know.
Well, it's that thing, like, it's like why Jeeps are so popular, right? Because people can buy a Jeep and they can do whatever they want to it.
Yeah
it's and I think that if you can apply that a lot, I mean, that's like the age-old battle between the PC and the Mac, you know, like, well, I can do what I want, I can customize my PC. I'm like the less time I'm on the damn computer, the happier I am. But I get your point, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that applies to anything. And if you can kind of create an avenue to allow people to personalize the things that they like and love, it's going to connect with an audience that likes to do that. Yeah, that makes sense to me. So, all right, where did you didn't fall afoul like JP and I did and end up at SVA? So, where did you go to school?
I went to Art Center in Pasadena.
Oh, okay.
So I went to the West Coast.
The cool school.
Well, when I was in Detroit area, I was lucky enough to have a good private teacher, mm-hmm. An illustrator who mostly did advertising and automotive stuff. And that was my other job in high school, was when I was in like 10th grade, I started teaching classes at his studio to kids. And he really helped me get my portfolio together. And when I found out that so many of my favorite artists, like at that time, it was so great knowing someone, his name was Ed Hubert, and knowing Ed, I could, you know, like Bill Sienkiewicz, you know, I would say, oh my God, I love this stuff. And I would show Ed and he'd say, oh, if you like this, you'll like Bob Peak.
Right.
You know, you'll like Bernie Fuchs, you'll like, you know, and so Ed was my first step towards, history of American illustration, mm-hmm. really, you know, and I had the Superman, the motion picture, the Star Trek, the motion picture, which I'm wearing a Bob Peak shirt right
there
now.
There you go. See?
So I had those posters on my wall as a kid, you know? So when I found out he went to Art Center and Ralph McQuarrie went to Art Center and, you know, and all these kind of guys that I idolized. So of course, you know, I was excited about going to California, mm-hmm. and doing that, you know, so
did you get
I ended up changing my major though, to film.
Oh, really?
But, yeah. So I end up kind of like using both of my, you know, different kinds of education all the time now. Mm-hmm. So, which is pretty fun.
What made you jump over to film? Like, what was the,
I think it was the, how much I love telling stories, mm-hmm. And drawing and painting and stuff. I wasn't as interested in like techniques and stuff like that, you mm-hmm. know, and I wasn't, and this was just as right before computers started to become a thing.
Right.
You know, as far as like now everybody, you know, at Art Center is designing, you know, and painting in the computer, you know? So, for me, it was all, once you get into like your fifth term, but the first couple of years at Art Center is all very drawing and painting from the model, very traditional. And once I have, after I had finished those first couple of years, where my interests led were more writing and like making films and storytelling. And I was getting work already doing like storyboards and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. My interests were really in that area. So I don't know. Then I went and did, you know, another couple of years with film stuff. And then I was so broke, that I just would take a term off and work. And then eventually I just never went back. So I never finished.
Oh, okay.
I finished, what was it? 8 terms would be 4 years. I did 7 terms.
Oh, jeez.
So I just basically was like, well, do I need the piece of paper? And I decided to just, you know, I was at the time doing a lot of stuff for Disney and some record companies and then starting to do some comics and everything. So then after a while I decided that, at the time before we got married, now my now wife Melissa, when she moved out to LA and finished her school at Cal State Northridge, and then we eventually decided, you know, we wanted certain things in life, like to be able to afford a house and have some land and raise our and have kids and things like that that we wanted out of our life together, and we decided that we would do better with that potentially leaving LA. So. Mm-hmm. Which I didn't think I would want to do as a teenager. You know, you think that's where all the magic is going to happen.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I visited some other comic creators that I had met at conventions. I visited them in North Carolina. It was Casey Jones and Mike Rowingo, mm-hmm. and John Van Fleet and just a handful of guys. And
yeah.
So I was able to visit them. And I had memories of going through North Carolina as a kid on trips. And I thought, well, let's give it a shot for a year. And that was in 1996. So it's been a long time. This is the longest I've ever lived anywhere.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's funny how you can look at that and go, oh boy, this is like, yeah. Like we moved to Asheville and my wife was like, oh, like we'll do 2 years here and then we'll figure something else out. You know, that was 12 years ago. So, you know, it just happens.
Yeah.
yeah, it's kind of huge. I was thinking about, like, you were talking about, you know, doing storyboard work and advertising work and all these kinds of gigs. And you just remember, I just think, like, how hard it is to remember how we did all that stuff. Because what we have available now, as far as our ability to communicate with one another and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, through text and emails and mobile calls, like, back then it was like at your house on your landline making phone calls. If you had a fax machine, you were like ahead of the game, you know. It was it was such a thing, like, and you just had to, like, do all of this hustle. And I think a lot of soft skills come into play where you just learn to talk to people and get,
yeah, sure,
you know, and get to the thing that you need.
And how to kind of, like, help each other out too. Like, I was so lucky to have, not only in school and certain teachers, I had Bern Hogarth was one of my teachers in school, which was huge, and certain guys that will make this huge impact. But then outside of school, I met Howard Chaykin mm-hmm. and Walter Simonson. And Walter was, speaking of the fax machine, he was like, you need a fax machine. And he got a new one and he gave me his old one.
Oh.
And, you know, so, and that's, and then, but he lived in New York. Mm-hmm. So he shipped it in the mail, the fax machine, to me in LA. And, wow. Like, what a nice guy. And it was great. Cause we were always faxing each other stuff. And, mm-hmm. and then I'd go to, like, one of their houses. Like, I would be faxing stuff to JP, like, in, you know, 93 or something. And then I'd go to New York and see that fax hanging on his wall. I was like, you know, it doesn't look anything like that in real
life. I remember, like, all the stuff that I would fax, like, so like Dave Johnson and I would fax a lot of stuff to each other. And, like, Dave's got a bold line, you know? And, like, yeah. I don't have the same kind of bold line. And I'm like, oh, like, this makes it look fat. You know, it's missing stuff. Like, all these things that the fidelity wasn't there. And it's so funny because Casey, I bumped into him at a show and he was, like, hanging out with me. He looked at my book and he's like, pointed a piece I had in my book. He's like, wait, you did this? And I was like, yeah. He's like, I've had a copy of this on my wall for, like, 3 years. And I'm like, oh, like, so, like, there was such a black market of, like, just people handing people other stuff that, who knew what you got? It was fun.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I had a studio with Howard and Mike Vosburg and Sean McManus and Steve Mitchell, and Steve Rude would come over all the time. Mm-hmm. And all these guys would just kind of, like, you know, leave stuff and trade stuff, give each other stuff, you know. So we had Xeroxes of all, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, I have all these really awesome Xeroxes. I have such a huge Toth collection.
You wait a minute. Like, what's his name? What was that guy's name?
John Hitchcock or somebody
No, there was a dude who went around at San Diego, and he had a great sketchbook with amazing pieces in it. And what he would do is he would mail you all of those Toth sheets.
Oh yeah. Daryl something, maybe.
Something, yeah. And he's like, listen, you know, do whatever you want in this. Just don't copy these and give these other people, you know? And I was like, all right, cool. And I kept my promise on that one until, like, a year and a half ago. And I finally just emailed somebody, like, the PDF. I made a PDF of the whole thing. And,
oh, cool.
But I'm like, I think the statute of limitations is long over at this point.
Now you can get all that stuff in a book. Well, but back then we'd be digging through, you know, dusty back issue bins mm-hmm. and all that stuff. I would have a list of, you know, what Toth books to try and find,
right.
And just go to random comic shops and just dig and try and find stuff. Now now you can just look it up online and somebody's already posted it and, you know, HD. So it's pretty funny.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I don't begrudge it at all because, like, listen, it's great to have access to when someone, like, because remember when you, like, someone's like, oh, there's this band, and you're like, it was just a huge effort to try to find music from random bands or whatever back when you had to, like, physically walk around and do this stuff. But now anything is accessible, which is great because you're never kind of late to the game. You can kind of get on board.
There's a really cool joke. I can't remember the comedian's name, but he was on Conan a lot years ago. And then he had his own show, like, after Conan. And he did these things where he plays, he does like kind of a joke on Christian Bale's Batman where dogs like this. And mm-hmm. yeah, I can't remember his name, but he did this really kind of long kind of story joke about how he met his, basically he had a Tom Petty concert shirt on, and he met another person with that same shirt or a similar shirt or whatever, and it spawned a whole, you know, kind of friendship, and that ended up where, you know, then, well, it, gosh, somehow it ended up where he discovered Tom Petty in the first place, you know, like years okay. ago when he was, and so that's how he discovered the music, blah blah blah, and all these kinds of things, and then it ended up where then he years later, you know, someone wearing that same shirt or something, and eventually, long story short, it's how he met his wife ultimately. Oh, wow. So it was like this really cool thing on just from a t-shirt, and then he found this music, and then found these relationships, and then he ended up meeting someone, and he wouldn't have experienced that by just looking online.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real world thing, and that's the kind of stuff that I value from those, like when I think about digging through those back issues, and you can, we all know the smell of that
mm-hmm.
newsprint, and my allergies are starting to go off, just, you know, like a Pavlovian response, you know, but it's that, it's such a cool, like, you know, and you meet people and you make friends, and like we're talking about, you're drawing and hanging out with our friends and stuff. So as much as I love having the instant access to all these things and having the internet, nothing will ever replace that, being able to, you know, like one thing, my son always played online video games with people, and I was like, but I was so glad that they actually got to know each other pretty well playing, like mm-hmm. you and I talking right now. Yeah. And then a couple of those friends who played online, then they'd end up making that extra effort to then, let's meet up sometime.
Oh, that's cool.
And they're in different states, mm-hmm. you know, and they would, I remember when they were in high school, and I just said, yeah, just, they can come stay here and, you know, whatever. And then always having that, and having that, being able to go and play D&D in person, being able to go to the comic shop and shoot the shit with the guys at the shop,
mm-hmm.
the stuff that I've had to force myself to, I go to the comic shop maybe like 4 times a year, and it's just so hard to get out.
Yeah.
That's why I've made it, which my wife always pushes me to make a conscious effort to, every Saturday I go hang out with the guys at the garage. I have my own stuff, but to go there and you have that social interaction and sharing ideas and learning from each other, you know, yeah. is huge.
Well, I think, I mean, in, I think part of that, I think when something bites into you, you will do the thing like go to the places and go to the stores or go mm-hmm. hunt the thing mm-hmm. down. I don't think that goes away, because I don't think, like, we talk about book sales a lot, and people aren't discovering a random great book on Amazon. Mm. It just doesn't happen. Like, unless someone you like, you know, suggests the book and it shows up on your, however the feed, you know, feeds it to you.
Right.
You don't find it. But when you go to a bookstore, a cover catches your eye. And you're like, what's that?
Yeah.
And then the shop owner is like, oh my God, that's a great book. You really, you know, like, if you like this, you'll love that. And you're like, well, I do like that, so I think I'll try this. Mm-hmm. And that's a big, big thing. And I think, there's this giant economy out there that happens in a digital form, but I don't think it'll ever, we will not give that up. The sort of the face-to-face version of whatever the life has.
I hope not.
I hope I can't. And it's testament. I think, you know, many people who are into comics, or, you know, whether they make them or read them, it's their, you know, they, it's a collector's bug. There's this thing of like mm-hmm. finding and acquiring mm-hmm. that doesn't.
Yeah.
And it can spread out. Yeah, treasure hunting.
When I was in Japan, so like half my trip was devoted to hunting for things that I could never get here, you mm-hmm. know, as far as like my collections go, you know. So finding those old, you know, Ultramans or Kamen Riders and stuff.
Right.
So and we got way too much of that.
Yeah, I know. So, I remember, so the Do you remember? I'm sure you used to go to the Books Kinokuniya up in New York when you would come up.
And
The one at Rockefeller Center, that huge.
Yeah, that's a good one. There's one in LA that's not quite as good.
Yeah. And so that was like, I don't know, 5 blocks from my apartment. So I would go there way too often. But, you know, you would like do your research and you'd find out like that, you know, Shiro had done like all this other stuff. And you're like, how do I get my hands on this stuff?
Yeah.
It's and then you just have to save your pennies and fly to Japan, apparently, to get that stuff.
Yeah. It only took me, you know, like 30 years to do it.
Yeah. But good timing. So how did you... So, I mean, you get out of school and you're scrapping like for this and that and the other thing. Like, how, like, for you, how did you view things at the time? Were you just like an opportunist of saying, I'll take whatever's coming to me that seems interesting or can pay the rent? Or were you like, I'm out of school, I'm broke? Because you had this film thing. Were you saying like, I'm going to keep doing film? Or how did you like frame it? Because, you know, like it or not, people love you for your comics. So how did that happen?
I just kind of did, you know, in the beginning, obviously you just take whatever, you mm-hmm. know, and then as time goes on, you can, if you're fortunate enough to, especially if you can start to get a reputation of things, for certain things, then you can sort of start to be a little more, you know, selective, and also not only selective on what projects you take, but who do you want to work with, you know, all that kind of stuff. So like in comics, for example, I think the first monthly book I ever did was this thing called Gemini Blood. And I worked with John Workman as the letterer, who I always wanted to work with. Mm-hmm. And since then, John has lettered every single book I've ever done, even books that I don't draw, if I have anything to do with it, like the Gotcha Man books, I'm only writing and doing the covers. He's doing all the lettering on the insides. There's a book that I'm doing through the game company, and John's lettering that. So there's certain people that you just gravitate to, and you know that you have to work with them on everything. But everybody, lots of people, they don't know what you're doing in another area if they don't know you really well. So, and people in those other, let's say other media, they would typecast you. So like if I was looking for a job and I was working on an animated movie and then there was a live action movie, the producers on that movie might say, well, we normally don't work with animation guys, mm-hmm. you know? Or I'd go to work on an animated movie. Oh, we don't work with comic guys, you know, you're that guy that does all that, you know, black and white kind of, you know, ink stuff. But then I also do paintings for all these Star Wars books and novels and posters and that aren't that, you know. Mm-hmm. So I get bored really easy. And so I always like to, and also I think as a part of like a rebellious sort of like, you can't label me, man. You know, like when I was a kid that sure. I always just kind of like, I didn't know if I wanted to do magazines or, you know, which obviously I couldn't because that's not a thing anymore, or movie posters, which obviously isn't a thing anymore, but, you know, but I liked all that stuff. Right. You know? So, and I didn't want to do comics to make a living. I didn't want to only do comics ever. Mm-hmm. So I always like to do, I mean, while I was doing, you know, comics, I always at the same time was doing other stuff. I never, ever did only comics. Mm-hmm. So, but people in comics know my comics. People that I work with in video games know my video games, but they also kind of know my comics, you know, or in movies, or like just this morning I was messaging with Albert Hughes, who's one of the Hughes brothers mm-hmm. that directed the Book of Eli, and I was the concept artist on that movie. And Albert and I were talking about, you know, a completely different project now, and we were sharing like a cinematic that I just directed for this game that's all 3D, and you know, completely like in comics, the people would have no idea that I do that stuff, you right. know? So it's all kind of relative. And for a while, like I got really, really sick of comics. It finally hit me really hard, really bad. A lot of it had to do with when JP passed away, mm-hmm. but it was at that time. And I was doing Jupiter's Legacy with Mark Miller yeah. for Netflix. And at that time, I just couldn't take it anymore. Before COVID, I was working as a production designer on a movie for Kerry Condren, who mm-hmm. did Sky Captain.
Yeah, 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 totally. I keep wondering, like, what happened to that dude?
Yeah. Yeah, he's one of those guys. He's got so many great ideas and he just can't catch a break, you know?
Right.
It's like, I mean, the best of the best. I mean, like Albert, speaking of him, Albert Hughes was developing the live action Akira movie for Warner Brothers. And we worked on that. Mostly he worked on that. And I did some stuff here and there when I could fit it in. But that was a year of his life and that fell apart, you know? So that kind of stuff happens all the time. So people, like if people, I get this all the time at conventions, they assume you're not doing anything if they don't know what you're doing.
Right. If you're not on the shelf, then you must be.
Oh, you must be like a lazy, you know, whatever.
Yeah. How long was that coma?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, oh, what you been doing? You know, it's like just stuff, you know, I'm not doing it for you. So I don't give a shit what you think.
Right.
Really, but yeah, I mean, I forget what I'm working on or what I've done because there's so many different things all the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I just love telling stories. So whatever yeah. the best medium is for doing that, like a few years ago, I sold a show to Fox. I wrote, this show, pitched it. I developed it with Film Roman, who's an animation company.
Mm-hmm,
they
sure.
did, and so they helped produce this, short. And then we developed it and I pitched it and then we got Andy Samberg attached to be the star. And then Bill Oakley came on who, you know, used to write and produce The Simpsons and he was going to be the showrunner. And then I got paid well from Fox to write and direct the pilot, all this stuff. It went great, but then we didn't go to series. So I finally got the rights back to it now. So maybe we'll do something with it. But that's another thing is like, you know, that show didn't come to fruition ultimately. Mm-hmm. So obviously I haven't been doing anything.
No, I mean, well, I'm glad I caught you between naps. yeah, but it's interesting because I think in the 90s when you and I both got into the business, you know, New York City was the center of the comic book industry.
Oh yeah.
And so if you went to New York with the idea of getting into comic books, your options are pretty high. There's a lot going on. And what, yeah. you know, but if you got out of school and you're in LA, we didn't have any film. There's no film in New York City. I mean, films mm-hmm. got done in New York, television, some television, but there really wasn't this, it wasn't generated there. It was being generated out West. So I think
if I stayed in LA, I would have gone more in that direction.
Yeah.
You know, because that was the place. And that's kind of like other guys I knew at that same stage in our lives, you know, were like that in New York, like you said, like mm-hmm. with the comics, you know, or guys I know who work in, you know, editorial illustration or advertising and stuff. And then I know people in marketing and advertising that were thriving in places like Chicago or Toronto. And so it just kind of, yeah, different places at different things. And then, yeah. And then film and all these things end up moving around. All of a sudden everybody was really busy in Eastern North Carolina making right. TV shows
totally.
With the tax breaks and everything. And now all that stuff moved to Georgia,
yep.
and, you know, so there's, you know, people sometimes move with it. I know lots of guys I work with in different crews that I'm moving to Georgia now or
yeah.
going to go live in Canada for the summer or, you know, whatever. So
they're like, you know, fruit pickers. They're just, they're just following the crop.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense. You know, I think if you're a kid with a lot of like creative impulses. And you sort of do a lot of different things as a child, whether it's model making or drawing or playing, you know, playing D&D or whatever the things you do, that kind of carries over as an adult into some different versions of that. And because I think if I, you know, if I was like, I think that's what burned me out in comics was I was only thinking about comic books the variety. And then when I stumbled into design, I was like, wait a minute, I don't have to do the same thing over and over again. Like it's going to be a different client with a different thing. I was like, well, this is great because it changed. Like every time you could take your same creative philosophy and apply it to something new, but it was a completely different project.
And you'd feel a sense of growth again too in yourself. Yeah. You know, like you'd learn a new skill, you'd pick up a new, you know, find a new thing that you liked or realize what you don't like.
Right.
You know, all those kinds of things. And, you know, working on all this stuff right before COVID. And then when COVID hit, luckily, Mark came to me with the Jupiter's Legacy comic because all the movies and everything had all shut down and there wasn't anything going on. Mm-hmm. And so I was happy to have that and just work on that while everybody was, you know, at their house. Mm-hmm. And, but man, I got, yeah, really burnt out, and partly because I had just not just career wise, but just in my life, I was yearning for more human contact and more like collaborative projects and stuff like that. So as soon as I was able to get away from doing Jupiter's Legacy, decided to get away. Yeah. So,
but you are finishing. Are you finishing it up or something like that? Is it?
The stuff that's finally coming out is stuff I did a couple of years ago.
Oh wow. Okay. I figured like, oh, you were done.
I thought it was done. I saw something about like, oh, coming out this August or whatever, and I was like, what? And yeah, so I thought it all had come out, but there's more that hadn't come out. Yeah, I was into it at first and I really pushed myself and mm-hmm. I was basically like painting the book in Photoshop, just doing full on these full color illustrations, and rather than doing like line and color like I would do on like it was all digital. So like on Grendel, Kentucky was the other book I did around that time, was all drawn with ink on board, you know, on mm-hmm. paper, you know, it was all traditional. That's the other thing is I'll get bored with something and decide I'm going to do this digital or I'm going to do this with ink. And this one, I'm going to, you know, it depends on the story and on the project.
Mm-hmm.
And where Grendel, Kentucky is sort of like an old Warren magazine kind of vibe, like a creepy and eerie kind of thing. The kind of books we liked when we were kids and where Jupiter's Legacy was more like felt like a slick kind of modern
mm-hmm.
Kind of more kind of thing with more glows and more color. And then at the time they were working on this TV show for Jupiter's Legacy, and I was thinking, well, this will be good because I knew Gerard was doing well with the Umbrella Academy show,
mm-hmm.
and that maybe that could help carry over into book sales. But ultimately that Jupiter's Legacy show was just god awful, and it got canceled, and they announced that it was canceled before the comic even came out. So all the shops basically put the brakes on ordering a bunch of copies.
Right.
So I don't really know if it really did that well. I know there's lots of fans out there of the series
mm-hmm.
and the Jupiter's Legacy stuff that came, you know, before, and it's a really great script. It's really fun stories.
Yeah. My local shop picked up a bunch of, they kept ordering it. So if I saw your name on it, I'm like, oh, I'll grab that, you know, and I would just, you know, cause I, you know, you always kind of grab your buddy's comic books, you know, make sure that keep them employed. But I think, you know, it's interesting. You're saying going back between the digital and the traditional is I think that's just like a classic drawing thing. Like I always say, you know, you'll plateau on anything you're working on. Like after a while, it's like exercise. Like you're going to acclimatize to whatever it is. And I remember, so, you know, John Ruggieri, So yeah, he was my teacher. He was my teacher as well. And, you know, I remember one day I was just struggling in class, you know, just, you know, the line wasn't there, you know, one of those drawing days. And he just walked over and he just grabbed my pencil or whatever I had in my hand and just reached into my box and pulled something out and just handed it to me. He's like, there you go, go. And, you know, and I'm sure he probably was mean and grabbed vine charcoal or something. And it was one of those things where I realized like what he was doing is saying, you need to relearn what you already know as quickly as possible. And that's what the new tool kind of provided, is that my mind had to solve this problem to be able to, and, you know, in the, you know, 1 minute pose, like solve it. You don't have you don't have an afternoon. You got to do it now. And I think that's kind of like that healthy thing, to be able to jump through it. Now, I don't think it works for everybody, how people design their careers, you know, especially in comic books, because a look is what people typically get hired for. It's very hard to go, like, there's this South American artist, Sebastian Pires, and he does this very sort of like, you know, solid, you know, what people are expecting comic book work from, but like he does all these drawings that he puts up online and they're insanely good, like great coloring, great stuff, super expression, you know, expressionistic. And I'm like, dude, do this. And he's like, I'm afraid to do this because I don't think they're going to hire me because they're expecting me to do this one thing. And I'm like, I don't know, man, if you can do a small project in this style and make it work, I think everybody's going to want you to do this stuff.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to, the way I draw my layouts, I have a certain way of drawing that a lot of people always tell me, oh, you should do a book like this. And I haven't had the courage to do it yet. You know,
I used to yell at Howard Porter, Howard's probably as good as a comic book artist can get, right? Like as a monthly dude, tons of detail, tons of stuff. And Howard would show me his layouts. I'm like, do the book like this, you know, because it was so vibrant, and you know, there were the
plus spontaneity to it.
Yeah. And the parts that were missing, you know, made it look like, you know, like a Mike Mignola drawing, you know, like it wasn't banking on line work to solve the problems. It was shapes. And I was like, oh, this is so perfect. And, but he, like, you know, I don't blame him. I mean, you're terrified to like try something new if it means you don't eat next month.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's another thing, like actually a lot of editors in comics would sometimes complain. I've actually literally heard some people say, yeah, well, with Tommy, you know, you don't really know what you're going to get. You know? Right. And so, you know, I haven't gotten that so much, you know, like last several years, but I used to get that a lot. Like, you know, they wanted, you know, like there's a book I did called Zombie World for Dark Horse a million years ago that Bob Fingerman wrote. And I did it was the first book where I was like, I'm going to do this all, like, it was very Milt Kniff kind of all brush stuff. And then the next thing I did ended up being more like line driven and, you know, just kind of changed it up. And the editor on that was like, oh, I was wanting that brush thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, well, I'm doing this. And, and that's always, you know, I've always had that, you know, I don't know. I mean, even like, when I just finished this Gatchaman cover, I did it all traditional because that's how I think of Gatchaman. I think of it as a traditional, you know, paintings from when I was a kid, stuff that was made in the early 70s. So, you know, we didn't see it till late 70s when it came to America, but all that stuff was all very early 70s, even late 60s inspired, and all, you know, gouache paintings and stuff. And so when it came time to get to draw this stuff, well, I'm not going to do it digitally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the editors ever knew if I'd do it digitally or draw it with ink and color it or paint it. They never asked.
Right.
They just, you know, luckily, hopefully they like all of it. But like right now, what I have on my desk right now is a loading screen for Fortnite, the video game.
Mm-hmm.
And like that, I'm doing digitally, partly because it works really well backlit on a monitor. I don't have to think about printing or paper, right, you know, stuff like that. So sometimes that will dictate the medium.
Sure.
As well.
Yeah. I mean, that's a classic, you know, design approach. It's like, well, what is actually going to be is going to dictate the execution. Like you can't, you can, but really it's a big battle to try to jam a square thing through a round hole if it doesn't
fit. Yeah. I love when, I've done some posters for, like retro poster, like screenings. We did an anniversary screening of The Thing years ago, and it was going to be a silkscreen poster. So that was like a whole nother, like, okay, cool. I'm going to, you know, figure out, you know, what's the best way to do that. And in high school, I used to make the screens and we'd print shirts, mm-hmm, and all that stuff. So I know how to, you know, like you were talking about, you knowing the mechanics of it. And so there right there is like, well, that dictated how I was going to approach the artwork, you know, because I knew I had only so many colors and stuff like that. So,
which is, it's, you know, and, you know, I'll say it every time if it's necessary, but it's the limitations that make us better. Plain and simple.
Yeah. There was one thing I always think of is, I did a series of The Question with Rick Veitch back in 2004. And when we first started writing it, we had this whole thing going, and then DC told us it had to take place in Metropolis. And I was like, why? And because, you know, they had their reasons. And so, well, and all of a sudden all these limitations came in, but then that ended up steering us towards creating a story that you could only do in Metropolis. Mm. And why the question, why do we need the question in Metropolis? They have Superman. And then that dictated our whole story. So sometimes, yeah, those limitations. If you have too many tools, too many possibilities, too much time, all those are real things that can mess you up.
They're your enemy every single day. We think of it as a luxury, but they're not. They're working against you at all cost. So what do you think that like I always like look at, like, you know, my job is always to try to find a smarter, quicker, you know, better way of doing the thing that I do every time I approach it. Like, how do I do this? How do I do that? Like, can you think of something like in the last, I guess, maybe 5-ish years that like you've brought into your work process that has improved what you do?
Again, it depends on the project and depends what I'm doing at the moment, you know. Like, usually I do my writing work at night. It's like a different muscle that, mm-hmm, I can do. Like, I'm so tired of drawing and talking to people all day. And that, which is funny, because now the past 2 years as creative director of this company, I'm like talking and giving people direction all the time. And that's probably a skill that grows with experience. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've always struggled with and will struggle with is how to delegate to other people, and how to trust other people. I mean, like I was just saying, like, John letters everything I do in comics. Like, I have to color everything. There were some times here and there when my wife, you know, colored some stuff, you know, early on. Like on Gotcha Man, they did a logo I didn't like. So I'm like, I have to do the logo for the book, you know? so it's that kind of like, I have a really hard time letting go. So if I can put together my team and I have my trusted people, I'm in really great shape, mm-hmm, and I'm really able to let go and say, okay, cool. Like, Sloan's got this, David's got that, you know, like, oh, you know. And, but then other times when you don't have that team that you've put together, sometimes you have to work with an author or, mm-hmm, a game studio or a modeler or, you know, all these different kinds of things that you didn't hand pick. You have to figure out how to recognize what can they do and try and hopefully bring the best out of them. Mm-hmm. And so that is something I've learned to do better. It doesn't really apply so much to comics, but it applies a lot to all my other work as far as like how I can, you know, delegate. And sometimes it doesn't work out,
yeah,
you know, obviously, but I think that has helped me in ways where I can, you know, be more efficient, you know, and how to, you know, get stuff done and, you know, kind of make choices and have to move things along, which we all have to do in every single job. Especially, I mean, there's no page that we're ever fully happy with or a story you're ever fully happy with, because you've had to make a compromise because you have to get it in and get paid and meet the schedule and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes learning to let go a little bit is something that I'm always trying to learn how to do.
No, thank God they take this stuff away from us, because we would just be working on the same group of pages or the same, what, you know, design forever if we were left to our own devices.
Yeah.
If the checks kept coming in and nobody questioned it, we would just keep working on the same thing till, you know, it was perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, it, by the way, it'll never be perfect, just so we are clear on that. So Gotcha Man, how did that come together? I mean, and you are sort of kind of being a bit of a creative director in this one, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't mean to be. I'm not. And I even told the editor, like, thanks for putting up with me. And thanks for, you know, I saw some promotion for the book yesterday, and they didn't use something exactly the right way, in my opinion. I contacted the, you know, people and everything, and I have to sort of like, and my wife reminds me, you know, Tommy, you're just supposed to be writing this thing. But I can't help it. Because I think about how good it can be from all aspects, and I would love to draw this stuff, but I don't have the time.
Right.
And I love being able to, so therefore I'm thinking, well, who can I work with that whose work that I really love that I can trust? It all again goes to that trust thing. Mm-hmm. And then how can I, cause I want to be proud of it. Like, they had a logo on the book that I didn't like, and I knew that, okay, I would have to show this thing and cringe every time I showed anybody the book.
Right.
And that's what you're always fighting against. Mm-hmm. Not that the logo was bad. It just wasn't right for the book, in my opinion. So it's a lot of like, so the way it came about was Mark Irwin, who is at Mad Cave Publishing.
The wonderful Mark Irwin. Yes.
Yeah. And he was, you know, an art director at Mad Cave, and his role has expanded a lot as the company has grown. And he contacted me knowing the kind of stuff that I like, wondering if I'd want to do artwork. And I said, I would love to draw Gotcha Man, but I'm way more interested in writing it. And I hadn't written a lot of comics. I wrote a book called Vandroid for Dark Horse, and wrote a Batman short, and I helped craft and come up with the Mother Panic series with Gerard Way. And I was set to write and draw like a whole arc, and when they canceled the book. And then I've written a lot of screenplays, and animation stuff. And so there's a lot of stuff that, like, you know, people have never seen, like the show I wrote and for Fox. So a lot of guys in comics, like a Mark or an editor or something, might go, oh, you want to write stuff? Because they didn't quite know that. So I just decided I really need to just start making that more known. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, yeah, I really want to write it. And I just kind of, if I was offered to write like X-Men or Batman or whatever, I would have no clue what to do. Mm-hmm. This is one of those few existing properties that I knew exactly, like you mentioned Ultraman earlier and stuff like I know exactly how to do this.
Yeah.
I felt I had that confidence level and that I was able to say, yes, I can do this. And then I basically just pitched why and what I would like to do. And they had two writers already, And one is Steve Orlando. Mm-hmm. Another one is Cullen Bunn.
Yeah, Cullen.
And they're Cullen's going to be doing the monthly book, mm-hmm. and which is I'm like great because I can't do a monthly book. And then Steve is doing kind of what I'm doing. They want to do a lot of stuff. So this was ended up being kind of perfect where we've got the three of us hit it off, and we basically have like a writing room kind of thing where we map out what we want to do. And then basically because I know the Japanese show so well, the Japanese version of it, mm-hmm. And Tatsunoko that owns Gatchaman that made the show, they want us to work within the first 105 episodes of the show, which is the classic show. And at first I was bummed out about that a little bit. I wanted to do like, what Hideki Anno did with Shin Godzilla or Shin Ultraman or Shin Kamen Rider and stay true to it. But how can we update it, mm-hmm. you know, and make it like my big thing was now as an adult, I wanted reasons for things.
What?
Like, yeah. So, which is so fun. And that's kind of what like Anno did with those things. Like why do they wear these helmets? Mm-hmm. Why is it a bird? Why is it so dangerous to go into Phoenix fire form that the ship does?
Right.
You know, all this stuff, like, you know, when you're a kid, you just accept, oh, these guys want to take over the world. They're bad guys, like Cobra, like Galactor.
Sure.
As an adult, you're like, why wouldn't it be so cool to give them a reason and why people follow them, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I was excited about that. And so they didn't completely shoot that down, but just like the Rick Veitch story I told about the question, they said, like I originally wrote a story idea of how Ken and Joe first meet. So two of the main characters mm-hmm. in Gatchaman, how they first met. And that idea got shot down immediately because they want us to stay within. Steve calls it dancing within the raindrops of basically we have certain things that happen in the show, certain characters. But man, we're really pushing the envelope. Like I'm constantly being told no. We can't do that, but then I'm told yes, we can on so much awesome stuff. Mm-hmm. So we've created all kinds of new characters. So I knew I wanted to create a lot of new characters for what's called Ken. I wanted to call it G1 because that's each character has G1 through right. 5. But they decided that we should do you know their names. You know Ken, Joe, Ryu. Jinpei and June. So I'm writing Ken, Jinpei and June.
Okay.
And then, so three of the books and then Steve's writing, Ryu, Joe. And then he's doing one on Dr. Nambu, the guy that runs mm-hmm. the Gatchaman. So, and this is, so we have 2 years of stuff planned out. So it's a lot of stuff and it's kind of a perfect amount for me. It's a lot of work, but mm-hmm. it's not like undoable with my other jobs. So primarily my main job and then like little illustration jobs and stuff like this. So and it keeps me doing some comic stuff
mm-hmm.
and then I get to do the covers
and something and, you love. No,
just, yeah. So, and oh man, I just, all I do like for work now is watch Gatchaman and I have to buy the toys because it helps me with reference.
Well, duh.
And so and I knew that I couldn't draw it, but who do I love working with already or that I'm friends with that I've always wanted to work with? So Mindy Lee has worked for me at Atmos working on game design stuff and animation design. And I've always wanted to see more comic stuff from her and mm-hmm. she's done some great comic stuff as well for like Dark Horse and DC. And especially when I knew that I wanted to tell a story that we made a lot of new characters.
Right.
One of her strengths is character design. And so she designed, I just basically wrote character descriptions of 10 new characters, mm-hmm. plus more like 11 because actually more like 12 because there's one character who's not new, but they're another character in disguise. Oh, okay. I don't want to spoil it. And then there's a disguise that Ken wears in the book. Mm-hmm.
Is that that's the sheet you sent me, like with all the character lines? Yeah. Okay, cool.
Those are all new characters.
Well, it makes sense. Like, you need to flesh out the world of these characters, like having these characters just interact with one another.
And then I think I don't want to ruin it, but I could kill all of them if I wanted to. Okay. Also. Because, and actually that's even better for Tatsunoko because they don't have to worry about, well, where do they fit in the lore,
right,
in the other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, it's kind of like when I think of my job as, creative director or production designer, or you put together a team, you figure out who's great at what. Mm-hmm. So the June one that I finished writing that script, and that these are 32 page one shots. So, and then I'm writing, a couple different 4-issue miniseries. One was going to be that story that they shot down about how Joe and Ken first meet. So I'm actually struggling to rethink it, you know?
Right.
And then there's a short, we all wrote short stories that come out next month on Free Comic Book Day. We have Gotcha Man number 0. And that one, there's a guy, Daniel Hansen, mm-hmm. that I've only known online. And you know, Daniel.
Well, that's where I was super curious because, you know, I had Daniel on as a guest. That's
crazy.
Two and a half years ago.
Yeah.
And he was a guy, you know, had all this art and he just kept liking all the episode stuff. And I'm like, who is this dude? So I started looking at his work. I'm like, oh, he's really, really good and talented and prolific, to say the least. And then so I had him on the show and he's like, I don't know why you want me on the show because I haven't done comic books yet. I'm like, well, it's not just specifically comic books. It's about creative process and journey. And so he did finally his first book last year came out. And and he's great. And he's great. Yeah. And so when I saw him say he did the drawing online, I'm like, well, wait a minute. How is this? What is, you know, and that's when I reached out to you and you're like, oh, well, yeah. And I'm like, all right. So.
Yeah, I approached him about doing Gotcha Man. So he was going to do one of the miniseries, but I think it's maybe a bit more of a heavy workload than I think Daniel was anticipating, mm-hmm. or maybe he's trying to fit in other things or whatever. But I think he's going to end up drawing the Jinpei one shot, 32 page one shot. So he's going to do that along with the one he's already done, which is what's cool is when I'm writing these, I have the artists in mind, like Mindy for Deathmatch. And Daniel, there's something about Daniel's work that you can tell, even if he's not inspired by, he must like Toth's work.
Oh yeah.
So I used a lot of the old, you know, Frontline Combat and Two Fisted Tales, Toth stuff, and like the old like Saber Jet and all those things as inspiration for our story. It's only 6 pages, and mm-hmm. there's not a whole lot you can do there. So right there, the format works as far as those old, you know, EC stories, but also it's all aviation stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's canon. Jet, which I loved when I was a kid.
Oh my God.
I
have a toy of it. They were the best.
Yeah. That and Red Impulse.
Oh, the Red Jets, like when that crew would show up, like, you know, in a formation, it was like, oh, this is the best.
Yeah, exactly. So this is Ken. He's been shot. He's in the final stages of a big giant battle with Galactor, and he has to and we're not sure if he's going to be able to make it back to base. And then Red Impulse shows up to help him make it back to base. And fans of Gotcha Man will know what Red Impulse means to Ken, mm-hmm. and how their characters, what they mean to each other. New readers will also be like, oh, this is cool. There's something up with these guys. Mm-hmm. But longtime fans and people who are into the stuff will be like, oh, dude, this is great, because, you know, they know something that maybe other people don't.
Yeah.
So I'm writing this stuff for the fans, but also obviously you don't have to know anything to enjoy the story. And then Eric Canetti is drawing the June one shot.
Dude, that's so great.
Yeah. And Eric is one of my, you know, longtime good friends, and his work is amazing. And my June story is all motorcycles. I mean, obviously her vehicle is a motorcycle, and I ride motorcycles and love motorcycles, and I love Kamen Rider, and I tried not to get too much inspiration from Kamen Rider, but there's a lot of, you know, it's motorcycles. It's, you know, it's got cyborgs. It's got, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff. And again, like, as I'm writing, you know, certain scenes, I'm just thinking about Eric drawing it, you know, and what I think are his strengths, you know, and what, as a fan, I want to see him draw.
Totally.
So my scripts are very, very descriptive and very, very, very full. But they're really just as inspiration, you know, for such great artists that they're going to do all the heavy lifting.
They were great. I mean, and you, thank you for sharing them, because I really enjoyed reading them. I love reading.
Oh, cool, man.
I love reading how other people write their scripts, you know, because I write my scripts and, you know, and I love getting to read how other people do them, and having the one with Daniel's artwork to be able to compare. Like, I literally went panel to panel by, like, okay, what did he do? What did he think about?
Oh, cool.
And, you know, and then, like, I got scared thinking about how every time I got a script coming in when I was younger drawing comics, I'm like, you know, cause there's all this pressure to really land every single, you know, page. But it was really cool. And I like how you describe everything. It's very clear. And it's not directive in the terms of, like, put this here, put this here, put this here. Mm-hmm. You're giving the frame shot, the frame size, and then you're giving the information in a clear fashion that it isn't, you know, problematic if someone who wants to have a little creativity, you know, in the game.
Yeah, there's certain rules I think you have to stay with that I apply to my own drawings, even if they're not in the script. I put them in the script. Like, every page has to have a establishing shot, a master shot, things. So when I'm writing, I think of, okay, I got to make sure that I provide the place for the artist to be able to put that there. You know, I mean, you probably will notice I'll put, like, wider establishing shot, or, you know, something like that. Or what I hate is when artists or the writer usually will make that the first shot. I like to reveal things a lot of times.
Yeah.
But we'll start on something close, and then we eventually, you know, pull back, and then you see, you know, like, what's happening. But again, it's all about what's important in the story. But yeah, I think, and then having a full script is important, all the dialogue and everything, so that you can fully execute the acting of the characters. Mm-hmm. You know how much space to leave for the balloons. You know where I have all the sound effects are in there. You know how to incorporate that into the design of your panel, into your page. And John Workman can really think about it too. Like, John has the lettering kind of, like, when the thing's already been, you know, penciled or laid out, you know, he's got the script, and he can kind of think ahead and see what's happening.
Mm.
So the lettering he's done on the Ken one shot is really great, because it's very incorporated into the art.
It looks like it's not just slapped on. Yeah. It was like one of those things where you go, oh, because, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I used to love drawing in, like, sound effects, you know, even though it wasn't my job, it was just a lot of fun to design it into the page. And
I like to design it and let John do it.
Right. Yeah. And that's, but, like, everything was super well incorporated into all the action. So,
yeah, it's it's been great. And the, like I said, the Mad Cave has been so supportive, and for one, giving me the chance to, you know, for, like, when Mark first contacted me, and then getting to talk to everyone else at the company, and for them to say, oh yeah, maybe, you know, they didn't have to say, well, but you draw comics, you know, write it, or, you know, whatever, or just like all the other things I've talked about where, well, you were in animation, not live action, or you do, you know, this chiaroscuro type stuff, not colorful stuff. And then people don't know that I've designed kids shows. I designed a movie called Gnomeo and Juliet. No, the sequel called Sherlock Gnomes,
okay,
which is a ridiculous kids movie, but the director I like working with. And so I designed the stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've designed princess shirts for Disney.
Right.
You know, each thing I do it my way and it looks like my work, you know, but mm-hmm. I can adapt to, you know, speaking of Casey Jones, he was working on some stuff at Disney and they wanted some very like, you know, kind of sumi brush style kind of stuff for adult apparel. And sometimes, you know, you're like, oh yeah, let's figure out how to do that. And, you know, so there's different ways to approach everything.
Yeah.
But anyway,
I think it's amazing. I mean, you know, one of my greatest creative lament is my first gig was a penciling gig, which is what I was aiming for at Marvel right out of school. But the schedule that there was no script yet. I had to wait for a script. So I went around trying to get more work and nobody would give me any work. So I ended up going into an editor's office and convinced them to agree to buy a script from me if I, you know, if, you know, it, you know, the caveat was it had to be good, but I like, if you bought it, can I draw it? And they were like, yeah. And I didn't learn the lesson. Like, I didn't realize like all I had to do was just keep hustling in that direction. I was thinking I just want to draw comic books.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because my mentor was always like, hey, like your job is to make the best comic book or the best thing, whatever you're doing is possible. And if that means you have to like rewrite the story structure, do it. Like make everything work the best way. And I just didn't really put it all together because I thought, oh, I just want to draw comic books. Like that was all I thought was the important thing. But as time goes on, I'm like, all I want to do is tell these stories and I don't care what the outlet is. And so I get the joy of writing it because it is this free, it is the biggest blank canvas you can possibly have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not like when I'm working on a movie or an animated TV show, there's budget constraints, you know, there's all these things that you don't have in a comic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah, the sky's the limit.
Yeah.
You know, but in the sense that when I work on that stuff and I get to put together a team, that's kind of what I'm enjoying on Gotcha Man is not only, I'm not just writing a script and handing it in and walking away. I'm lucky enough that Mad Cave is cool with me going, you know, so like, you know, I can't do anything like part way, you know, but, mm-hmm. And luckily, you know, they're not like, oh, we don't like, you know, like when I sent them Daniel's work to do the short, you know, they responded and were like, yeah, great. I mean, I'm not sending them crappy art, you know, so at least, you know, got that going for it, but, you know, but they didn't. They hadn't worked with him. They hadn't worked with Mindy before. You know, they, I think they knew, you know, their work or they knew like, Eric Canetti's work, but you know, it's like, so I think I can bring some of the, it's sort of with my game stuff, or if I'm working on a movie or something where I do get to put together a team, the other artists will want to work on it because they know I'm going to be, you know, getting to direct them on it. So, because I've been on their side all the time. So that's when I'm writing the script, I think about what script do I wish was given to me?
Yeah. I love that.
What kind of freedom do I wish I had? What kind of direction do I wish I had? What kind of clarity do I wish I had that I don't often get, you know? So, and I feel like the more ideas, the better, because you can always edit them out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
So it's all just inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And the best ideas are hopefully going to rise to the top, and then, you kind of get trim the fat.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
usually, like when you're writing, you know, you go, okay, you write and you write this crazy, dirty draft, and you throw everything in there, and then you go, all right, this is ridiculous. Yeah. I just start trimming.
No. Cannot possibly have all this in here. No one's going to print it if it is. Yeah, that's, I mean, that really is the whole thing. It's so cool. I mean, I'm just like the biggest, you know, cheerleader for so many, you know, artists to write their stuff. And it's not that I'm knocking writers, because I don't really draw anymore. So I guess I'm in that camp, but I just think of how much story I wanted to tell, but I didn't have the freaking guts to do that. And the greatest satisfactions I ever had were the times that I actually did that. So it's one of these things where I just constantly say that, you know, just try it. I know it's scary. I know dialogue is dreadful when you first give it a run, but don't be afraid. Just tackle it, because the end result, super satisfying.
Oh yeah. And that is like where my goals are, is I, whatever my next comic is that I draw, it's going to be all me. So I don't know when or where that exactly is going to be, but I have a few different things that I want to do. One is a little intimidating because it's kind of massive, but another one I have is a little simpler. So yeah, so we'll see. For now, I'm just kind of like happy doing, you know, this, the writing, the Gotcha Mans, and there's a little bit of like business stuff too, where I'm thinking maybe before I come out with my own book, I'll have a bit more writing under my belt for retailers and people like that to go, oh yeah, that's the guy that wrote Gotcha Man.
Right. Because like,
not just the guy that drew, you know,
wait, don't you just draw?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
So there is a little bit of that in my brain as I'm trying to think ahead.
Yeah.
So for when I do, whether it's, I chip away at it while I'm working on the game stuff, or maybe it's something I do when I'm done with this, if I get tired of this or the company goes down, or you never know.
You don't know.
You know, all those kinds of things. So you got to be thinking ahead a little bit on what your next move might have to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't. Yeah, exactly. Just have a bunch of option maps laid out that you can just grab. And
to have options is such
a luxury.
Oh yeah, man. I mean,
but you create that luxury. That luxury just doesn't, they don't hand the luxuries out. Like, you have to make, you know, pay the dues to get the luxuries.
Yeah. At the same time, like, yeah, I think I don't want to take it for granted, you know, because we've always been in those places where all of a sudden, you know, oh, there's nothing going on, or there's nothing to do.
It's the worst feeling.
So we've all been there as freelancers, I mean, I made a conscious choice 2 years ago to take this salary job. So I'm able to do certain things that as a freelancer were harder to do, like go to Japan or to build a hobby house. You know, but now, but then maybe in another year, I might decide I don't really need that right now. I really feel creatively like I'm gonna, you know, blah, 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 you know, do this other thing, or go work on a movie, or do my own comic or whatever. So I don't know.
Isn't that the battle? That's the battle, man. It's the battle is between getting to play with other people's toys, which is great, but making your own toys is also pretty damn good.
Yeah. And getting, well, the battle has always been for everybody is making your own toys and getting to play with your own toys, but making a living while you get to play with your own toys. Right. That's the hard part.
That's
everyone's dream.
Yeah.
So everyone's dream is to, you know, get to do what, you know, Mike Mignola or Robert Kirkman or Frank Miller or all these guys who get to, you know, come up with their own stuff and make it a reality.
Yeah.
So that's, and now that like my kids are, you know, mostly self-reliant now, they're in their 20s and things like that, and there aren't things that I, you know, you can sort of focus more on things that you've always wanted to do, whether that be working on cars or doing your own comic, you know. So So that I'm kind of at that stage right now where I'm, you know, wanting to kind of figure out what's important for me to chip away at now.
You got to keep it interesting. If it's not interesting, it's, I don't know why we do it. Just go back to Burger King and flip burgers, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel. So when does Gatchaman come out for, do you know, like when the world, or do I have to go bug Mark?
I think, well, the Free Comic Book Day is the
4th?
May 4th. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do a signing in North Carolina at Ultimate Comics in Cary. And actually Cullen and Steve are coming as well. So there'll be all the Gatchaman writers together. And that's Alan Gill, who owns those shops. I used to co-own the North Carolina Comic Con and run that convention with him in Durham. I don't have the bandwidth for that anymore. So, but we're always, you know, helping each other and supporting each other, for the, you know, anything we can do with our local community. So, so I'm going to do that. And then I think in June, I'm pretty sure that's when, Ken comes out.
Okay.
My first one shot, and the monthly Gatchaman, which is Colin and Chris Batista is drawing that.
Sure.
And Chris I didn't know Chris before this, and he was like born to draw Gatchaman. It's crazy,
dude.
Like,
he's been. So Chris went to SVA with us. He might have been a year behind me or a year before JP, like somewhere in between JP and myself. And Chris, I think even back then was pitching Gatchaman left and right.
Yeah. Oh my God. This is kind of perfect and way better him to get to do this than if he did the Battle of the Planets version of stuff, which obviously that's what most of us know more anyway, but I think he's really well suited for the original Tatsunoko version of the stuff, because it's more mature. Mm-hmm. It's more sophisticated. There's more stuff you can do as far as, action and violence and, you know, stuff that obviously you couldn't do on television, when we were kids in America. So he's doing that, and there's, it's cool, 'cause we're going to get like a bunch of different versions of Gatchaman stuff. So, but we're all super fans, so it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, which is great.
So when we all sit around and talk about it, it's like, oh dude, what if you did this? Or, you know, there are some characters that Cullen is introducing that are new, that one of them spins off into the second mini series that I'm writing.
Oh, okay.
So it's that kind of stuff that we're trying to do. Like, Steve is going to do a Red Impulse story. There's, you know, certain things that we'll through communicating with each other, we'll come up with ideas and give each other ideas on how we can kind of bridge the gaps and make sure, do you know this episode or that episode? Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a way to tie those in together, or maybe those characters that we're creating are an early version of this or that that we saw in the show, or did that character really die in that episode? Maybe we get to do something with them in the comic, you know? So there's like so much cool inspiration. It's great, man. A few years ago, I wrote a G.I. Joe project that Hasbro shut down. IDW signed on. We're all set to do it. And I was going to draw it, and David Gianfelice was going to draw it. I was going to write it. And so I had it all written, and we were ready to start. And Hasbro decided it was too retro.
Oh.
This was at the time when they were like, you know, they had done the one with The Rock, and they were trying to do the Snake Eyes live action movie. And,
right.
And they're really trying to push the stuff more into, you know, something that for a lot of old time fans didn't feel like G.I. Joe. So I'm kind of getting to do a little bit with Gatchaman what I wanted to do with G.I. Joe, kind of like just do the stuff that we really loved,
yeah,
you know, and stay true to it. But at the same time, you know, there's some stuff that you can do to make a little more, like I said, have some reasons behind some stuff, you know, you know, add a little bit of, you know, and stuff also like that you couldn't do back in the day. If you wanted to do, stories that deal with, you know, LGBTQ stuff mm-hmm. and a gotcha thing. Like you could do that now. You could do, you know, stuff that you couldn't do in the early 70s, you know. So although the main bad guy is, you know, Berg Kotze, who's very the most gender bending villain of all,
of course.
So which is a big part of the story that I do with Mindy, the Ken story.
That's cool.
So there's some fun Berg Kotze stuff in there.
That's very cool. Yeah, that was always
there's a whole Galactor series that is doing. So pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I mean when we were kids we're like, wait a minute. So
yeah.
It was that's a lot of lip gloss. Let's just leave it there.
And in the American version, they edited the hell out of that stuff to try and work their way around it.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I still picked up on it as a 10-year-old. Yeah.
And in the Japanese one, it's very clearly not different people. When you'd see other people, mm-hmm. it was the same person, different genders.
That's well, so. They underestimated us for so long.
Yeah, and I think that in it's amazing to watch the stuff they did in this show 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
You know, character-wise, and some of the animation techniques blow me away. Some of the color design, like, it's super inspiring. So
I used to get up at 7, I guess I used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they played our reruns of Battle of the Planets at 6:30 in the morning where I lived. So I would get up and I would do whatever I needed to do between that to 6:30. I'd watch the half hour show, then, you know, have breakfast and go to school. And one morning I just woke up on the couch. The TV was off. I'd woken up and walked from my bedroom to the, you know, TV room. Sleep. And went to sleep, back to sleep on the couch. I just slept walked in there. That's how obsessed I was with that show as a kid. It was worth getting up for.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, I'll let you go. This is super exciting. Obviously, super nerdy, exciting stuff. So I'm super excited. Yeah. And we'll have to chat some more, I guess, when everything comes out. Are you going to show up to Heroes this year, you think?
Yes, I will go to Heroes Con. I'm actually gonna set up this year.
Damn, all right. Good. Now I know where to put my stuff when I walk around.
Yeah. So I'm actually gonna set up. I haven't had the chance to do that in a few years. Oh, good. So usually I show up and I walk around just to visit everybody, but this year I'm gonna be there the whole time.
Right on, man.
And then because you know, every you know the Ken thing will come out, and then a few months after that, or the June one will come out, mm-hmm. and then a little while after that, then my miniseries will come out, you know, and
it's good timing.
And apparently the Jupiter's Legacy stuff is going to be coming out. So
you're a big time comic book guy now. That's what happened just out of the blue.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that's great, man. I'm super pumped and I can't wait to actually see the things in hand versus on screen.
Yeah. I got the Free Comic Book Day one in my hands and it feels good.
Nice. That's awesome. Well, mon frere, you good? This took us a while to get this done, but I'm glad that we sat down.
Yeah, same here. It was really cool, man. Yeah. I appreciate it. You did a great job interviewing.
Oh, well, I don't know about that. I like to talk.
Well, at least I feel like we're just having a nice chat, which is good.